4. Two buildings on the outskirts had been burned. The rest of the town appeared dusty but intact. They passed an abandoned livery stable on the left, a building that might have been a market on the right, and then they were in the town proper, such as it was. There were perhaps a dozen rickety buildings standing on either side of the road. Alleys ran between some of them. The other road, this one a dirt track mostly overgrown with plains grass, ran northeast to southwest. Susanna looked at its northeast arm and thought once there were barges on the river, and somewhere down that road there was a landing, and probably another shacky little town, mostly saloons and cribs, built up around it. That was the last point of trade before the barges went on down to the city. The wagons came through this place, going to that place, and then back again. How long ago was that? She didn't know, but a long time from the look of this place. Somewhere a rusty hinge squalled monotonously. Somewhere else one shutter clapped lonesomely to and fro in the plain's wind. There were hitching rails, most of them broken, in front of the buildings. Once there had been board sidewalks, but now most of the boards were gone, and grass grew up through the holes where they had been. The signs on the buildings were faded, but some were still readable, written in a bastardized form of English, which was, she supposed, what Roland called the low speech. "Food and grain," one said, and she guessed that might mean feed and grain. On the false front next to it, below a crude drawing of a plains buffalo lying in the grass, were the words "rest, eat, drink." Under the sign, bat-wing doors hung crookedly, moving a little in the wind. "Is that a saloon?" She didn't know exactly why she was whispering, only that she couldn't have spoken in a normal tone of voice. It would have been like playing Clinch Mountain Breakdown on the banjo at a funeral. "It was," Roland said. He didn't whisper, but his voice was low-pitched and thoughtful. Jake was walking close by his side, looking around nervously. Behind them, Oi had closed up his distance to 10 yards. He trotted quickly, head swinging from side to side like a pendulum as he examined the buildings. Now Susanna began to feel it, that sensation of being watched. It was exactly as Roland had said it would be, a feeling sunshine had been replaced by shade. "There are people, aren't there?" she whispered. Roland nodded. Standing on the northeast corner of the crossroads was a building with another sign she recognized. "Hostel," it said, and "Cots." Except for a church with a tilted steeple up ahead, it was the tallest building in town, 3 stories. She glanced up in time to see a white blur, surely a face, draw away from one of the glassless windows. Suddenly she wanted to get out of here. Roland was setting a slow, deliberate pace, however, and she supposed she knew why. Hurrying might give the watchers the impression that they were scared, and that they could be taken. All the same... At the crossroads, the intersecting streets widened out, creating a town square which had been overrun by grass and weeds. In the center was an eroded stone marker. Above it, a metal box hung on a sagging length of rusty cable. Roland, with Jake by his side, walked toward the marker. Eddie pushed Susanna's chair after. Grass whispered in its spokes, and the wind tickled a lock of hair against her cheek. Further along the street, the shutter banged and the hinge squealed. She shivered and brushed the hair away. "I wish he'd hurry up," Eddie said in a low voice. "This place gives me the creeps." Susanna nodded. She looked around the square, and again she could almost see how it must have been on market day, the sidewalks thronged with people, a few of them town ladies with their baskets over their arms, most of them wagoners and roughly dressed bargemen. She did not know why she was so sure of the barges and bargemen, but she was. The wagons passing through the town square, the ones on the unpaved road raising choking clouds of yellow dust as the drivers flogged their cart horses, oxen, they were oxen, along. She could see those carts, dusty swatches of canvas tied down over bales of cloth on some, and pyramids of tarred barrels on others. Could see the oxen, double-yoked and straining patiently, flicking their ears at the flies buzzing around their huge heads. Could hear voices and laughter, and the piano in the saloon pounding out a lively tune, like Buffalo Gals or Darlin' Katie. "It's as if I lived here in another life," she thought. The gunslinger bent over the inscription on the marker. "Great Road," he read. "Lud, 160 wheels."
"Wheels?"
Jake asked. "An old form of measurement." "Have you heard of Lud?" Eddie asked. "Perhaps," the gunslinger said, "when I was very small."
"It rhymes with crud," Eddie said. "Maybe not such a good sign."
Jake was examining the east side of the stone.
"River Road. It's written funny, but that's what it says."
Eddie looked at the west side of the marker.
"It says Jimtown, 40 wheels. Isn't that the birthplace of Wayne Newton, Roland?"
Roland looked at him blankly.
"Shet my mouth," Eddie said, and rolled his eyes.
On the southwest corner of the square was the town's only stone building, a squat, dusty cube with rusty bars on the windows. Combination county jail and courthouse, Susanna thought. She had seen similar ones down south. Add a few slant parking spaces in front, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference. Something had been daubed across the facade of the building in fading yellow paint. She could read it, and although she couldn't understand it, it made her more anxious than ever to get out of this town. "Pubes die," it said.
"Roland,"
when she had his attention, she pointed at the graffito.
"What does that mean?"
He read it, then shook his head. "Don't know." She looked around again. The square now seemed smaller, and the building seemed to be leaning over them.
"Can we get out of here?"
"Soon." He bent down and pried a small chunk of cobble out of the roadbed. He bounced it thoughtfully in his left hand as he looked up at the metal box which hung over the marker. He cocked his arm, and Susanna realized an instant too late what he meant to do.
"No, Roland!"
she cried, then cringed back at the sound of her own horrified voice. He took no notice of her, but fired the stone upward. His aim was as true as ever, and it struck the box dead center with a hollow metallic bang. There was a whir of clockwork from within, and a rusty green flag unfolded from a slot in the side. When it locked in place, a bell rang briskly. Written in large black letters on the side of the flag was the word, "Go."
"I'll be damned," Eddie said. "It's a Keystone Cop's traffic light. If you hit it again, does it say stop?"
"We have company," Roland said quietly, and pointed toward the building Susanna thought of as the county courthouse. A man and a woman had emerged from it and were descending the stone steps.
"You and the Cupid doll, Roland," Susanna thought. "They're older'n God, the both of 'em."
The man was wearing bib overalls and a huge straw sombrero. The woman walked with one hand clamped on his naked, sunburned shoulder. She wore homespun and a poke bonnet, and as they drew closer to the marker, Susanna saw she was blind, and that the accident which had taken her sight must have been exceedingly horrible. Where her eyes had been, there were now only two shallow sockets filled with scar tissue. She looked both terrified and confused.
"Be they hair your sigh,"
she cried in a cracked, quavering voice.
"You'll have us killed yet, I warrant." "Shut up, Mercy," he replied.
Like the woman, he spoke with a thick accent Susanna could barely understand.
"They ain't harriers, not these. There's a pube with them, I told you that. Ain't no harrier ever been traveling with a pube."
Blind or not, she tried to pull away from him. He cursed and caught her arm.
"Quit it, Mercy, quit it, I say. You'll fall down and do yourself evil, damn it."
"We mean you no harm," the gunslinger called. He used the high speech, and at the sound of it the man's eyes lit up with incredulity. The woman turned back, swinging her blind face in their direction.
"A gunslinger!"
the man cried. His voice cracked and wavered with excitement.
"For God! I knew it were! I knew!"
He began to run across the square toward them, pulling the woman after. She stumbled along, helplessly, and Susanna waited for the inevitable moment when she must fall. But the man fell first, going heavily to his knees, and she sprawled painfully beside him on the cobbles of the great road. Five. Jake felt something furry against his ankle and looked down. Oi was crouched beside him, looking more anxious than ever. Jake reached down and cautiously stroked his head, as much to receive comfort as to give it. Its fur was silky, incredibly soft. For a moment he thought the bumbler was going to run, but it only looked up at him, licked his hand, and then looked back at the two new people. The man was trying to help the woman to her feet and not succeeding very well, her head craned this way and that in avid confusion. The man named Sai had cut his palms on the cobblestones, but he took no notice. He gave up trying to help the woman, swept off his sombrero, and held it over his chest. To Jake, the hat looked as big as a bushel basket.
"We bid ye welcome, gunslinger," he cried. "Welcome indeed. I thought all your kind had perished from the earth, though it did."
"I thank you for your welcome," Roland said in the high speech. He put his hands gently on the blind woman's upper arms. She cringed for a moment, then relaxed and allowed him to help her up. "Put on your hat, old-timer. The sun is hot." He did, then just stood there, looking at Roland with shining eyes. After a moment or two, Jake realized what that shine was. Sai was crying.
"A gunslinger! I told you, Mercy. I seen the shooting iron and told you." "No harriers?"
she asked, as if unable to believe it.
"Are you sure they ain't harriers, Si?"
Roland turned to Eddie. "Make sure of the safety, and then give her Jake's gun." Eddie pulled the Ruger from his waistband, checked the safety, and then put it gingerly in the blind woman's hands. She gasped, almost dropped it, then ran her hands over it wonderingly. She turned the empty sockets where her eyes had been up to the man.
"A gun," she whispered. "My sainted hat." "Ah, some kind," the old man replied dismissively, taking it from her and giving it back to Eddie. "But the gunslinger's got a real one, and there's a woman got another. She's got a brown skin, too, like my dad said the people of Garland had."
Oi gave his shrill, whistling bark. Jake turned and saw more people coming up the street, five or six in all. Like Sai and Mercy, they were all old, and one of them, a woman hobbling over a cane like a witch in a fairy tale, looked positively ancient. As they neared, Jake realized that two of the men were identical twins. Long white hair spilled over the shoulders of their patched homespun shirts. Their skin was as white as fine linen, and their eyes were pink. Albinos, he thought. The crone appeared to be their leader. She hobbled toward Roland's party on her cane, staring at them with gimlet eyes as green as emeralds. Her toothless mouth was tucked deeply into itself. The hem of the old shawl she wore fluttered in the prairie breeze. Her eyes settled upon Roland.
"Hail, gunslinger, well met."
She spoke the high speech herself. And like Eddie and Susanna, Jake understood the words perfectly, although he guessed they would have been gibberish to him in his own world.
"Welcome to River Crossing."
The gunslinger had removed his own hat, and now he bowed to her, tapping his throat three times rapidly with his diminished right hand. "Thank ye, Sai, old mother." She cackled freely at this, and Eddie suddenly realized Roland had at the same time made a joke and paid a compliment. The thought which had already occurred to Susanna now came to him. This is how he was, and this is what he did. Part of it, anyway.
"Gunslinger ye may be, but below your clothes you're but another foolish man," she said, lapsing into low speech.
Roland bowed again. "Beauty has always made me foolish, mother." This time she positively cawed laughter. Oi shrank against Jake's leg. One of the albino twins rushed forward to catch the ancient as she rocked backward within her dusty, cracked shoes. She caught her balance on her own, however, and made an imperious shooing gesture with one hand. The albino retreated.
"Be ye on a quest, gunslinger?"
Her green eyes gleamed shrewdly at him. The puckered pocket of her mouth worked in and out. "Aye," Roland said. "We go in search of the Dark Tower." The others only looked puzzled, but the old woman recoiled and forked the sign of the evil eye. Not at them, Jake realized, but to the southeast along the path of the beam.
"I'm sorry to hear it," she cried, "for no one who ever went in search of that black dog ever came back. So said my grandfather and his grandfather before him. Not airy one."
"Ka," the gunslinger said patiently, as if this explained everything. And Jake was coming to realize to Roland it did.
"Aye," she agreed. "Black Dog Car. Well, well, ye'll do as ye're called, and live along your path, and die when it comes to the clearing in the trees. Will ye break bread with us before ye push on, gunslinger, you and your band of knights?"
Roland bowed again. "It has been long and long since we have broken bread in company other than our own, old mother. We cannot stay long, but yes, we'll eat your food with thanks and pleasure." The old woman turned to the others. She spoke in a cracked and ringing voice. Yet it was the words she spoke, and not the tone in which they were spoken, that sent chills racing down Jake's back.
"Behold ye, the return of the white! After evil ways and evil days, the white comes again. Be of good heart and hold up your heads, for ye have lived to see the wheel of Ka begin to turn once more."
6. The old woman, whose name was Aunt Talitha, led them through the town square and to the church with the leaning spire. It was the Church of the Blood Everlasting, according to the faded board on the Runderiot lawn. Written over the words, in green paint that had faded to a ghost, was another message. Death to Greys. She led them through the ruined church, hobbling rapidly along the center aisle, past the splintered and overturned pews, down a short flight of stairs, and into a kitchen so different from the ruin above that Susanna blinked in surprise. Here everything was neat as a pin. The wooden floor was very old, but it had been faithfully oiled and glowed with its own serene inner light. The black cook stove took up one whole corner. It was immaculate, and the wood stacked in the brick alcove next to it looked both well chosen and well seasoned. Their party had been joined by three more senior citizens, two women and a man who limped along on a crutch and a wooden leg. Two of the women went to the cupboards and began to make themselves busy. A third opened the belly of the stove and struck a long sulphur match to the wood already laid neatly within. A fourth opened another door and went down a short set of narrow steps into what looked like a cold pantry. Aunt Talitha, meanwhile, led the rest of them into a spacious entry at the rear of the church building. She waved her cane at two trestle tables which had been stored there under a clean but ragged dropcloth, and the two elderly albinos immediately went over and began to wrestle with one of them. "Come on, Jake," Eddie said. "Let's lend a hand."
"Nope," Aunt Talitha said briskly. "We may be old, but we don't need company to lend a hand. Not yet, youngster."
"Leave them be," Roland said. "Old fools will rupture themselves," Eddie muttered, but he followed the others, leaving the old men to their chosen table. Susanna gasped as Eddie lifted her from her chair and carried her through the back door. This wasn't a lawn, but a showplace, with beds of flowers blazing like torches in the soft green grass. She saw some she recognized, marigolds and zinnias and phlox, but many others were strange to her. As she watched, a horsefly landed on a bright blue petal, which at once folded over it and rolled up tight.
"Wow," Eddie said, staring around. "Bush gardens."
Si said, "This is the one place we keep the way it was in the old days, before the world moved on. And we keep it hidden from those who ride through, pubes, grays, harriers. They'd burn it if they knew, and kill us for keeping such a place. They hate anything nice, all of them. It's one thing all those bastards have in common."
The blind woman tugged his arm to shush him.
"No riders these days," the old man with the wooden leg said. "Not for a long time now. They keep closer into the city. Guess they find all they need to keep 'em well right there."
The albino twins struggled out with the table. One of the old women followed them, urging them to hurry up and get the hell out of her way. She held a stoneware pitcher in each hand.
"Sit ye down, gunslinger," Aunt Talitha cried,
sweeping her hand at the grass.
"Sit ye down, all."
Susanna could smell 100 conflicting perfumes. They made her feel dazed and unreal, as if this was a dream she was having. She could hardly believe this strange little pocket of Eden, carefully hidden behind the crumbling facade of the dead town. Another woman came out with a tray of glasses. They were mismatched but spotless, twinkling in the sun like fine crystal. She held the tray out first to Roland, then to Aunt Talitha, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake at the last. As each took a glass, the first woman poured a dark golden liquid into it. Roland leaned over to Jake, who was sitting tailor-fashion near an oval bed of bright green flowers with Oi at his side. He murmured, "Drink only enough to be polite, Jake, or we'll be carrying you out of town. This is Graff, strong apple beer." Jake nodded. Talitha held up her glass, and when Roland followed suit, Eddie, Susanna, and Jake did the same. "What about the others?" Eddie whispered to Roland. "They'll be served after the voluntary. Now be quiet."
"Will ye set us on with a word, gunslinger?" Aunt Talitha asked.
The gunslinger got to his feet, his glass upraised in his hand. He lowered his head as if in thought. The few remaining residents of River Crossing watched him respectfully, and Jake thought a little fearfully. At last he raised his head again.
"Will you drink to the earth and to the days which have passed upon it?" he asked. His voice was hoarse, trembling with emotion. "Will you drink to the fullness which was, and to friends who have passed on? Will you drink to good company well met? Will these things set us on, old mother?"
She was weeping, Jake saw, but her face broke into a smile of radiant happiness all the same, and for a moment she was almost young. Jake looked at her with wonder and sudden dawning happiness. For the first time since Eddie had hauled him through the door, he felt the shadow of the doorkeeper truly leave his heart.
"Aye, gunslinger," she said, "fair spoken. They'll set us on by the league, so they shall."
She tilted her glass up and drank it at a draught. When the glass was empty, Roland emptied his own. Eddie and Susanna also drank, although less deeply. Jake tasted his own drink and was surprised to find he liked it. The brew was not bitter, as he had expected, but both sweet and tart, like cider. He could feel the effects almost at once, however, and he put the glass carefully aside. Oi sniffed at it, then drew back and dropped his muzzle on Jake's ankle. Around them, the little company of old people, the last residents of River Crossing, were applauding. Most, like Aunt Talitha, were weeping openly. And now other glasses, not so fine but wholly serviceable, were passed around. The party began, and a fine party it was, on that long summer's afternoon beneath the wide prairie sky. 7. Eddie thought the meal he ate that day was the best he had had since the mythic birthday feasts of his childhood, when his mother had made it her business to serve everything he liked, meatloaf and roasted potatoes and corn on the cob and devil's food cake with vanilla ice cream on the side. The sheer variety of the edibles put before them, especially after the months they had spent eating nothing but lobster meat, deer meat, and a few bitter greens, which Roland pronounced safe, undoubtedly had something to do with the pleasure he took in the food. But Eddie didn't think that was the sole answer. He noticed that the kid was packing it away by the plateful and feeding a chunk of something to the bumbler crouched at his feet every couple of minutes, and Jake hadn't been here a week yet. There were bowls of stew, chunks of buffalo meat floating in a rich brown gravy loaded with vegetables, platters of fresh biscuits, crocks of sweet white butter, and bowls of leaves that looked like spinach but weren't exactly. Eddie had never been crazy about greens, but at the first taste of these, some deprived part of him awoke and cried for them. He ate well of everything, but his need for the green stuff approached greed, and he saw Susanna was also helping herself to them again and again. Among the four of them, the travelers emptied 3 bowls of the leaves. The dinner dishes were swept away by the old women and the albino twins. They returned with chunks of cake piled high on 2 thick white plates and a bowl of whipped cream. The cake gave off a sweetly fragrant smell that made Eddie feel as if he had died and gone to heaven.
"Only buffalo cream," Aunt Talitha said dismissively. "No more cows. Last one croaked 30 year ago. Buffalo cream ain't no prize winner, but better nothing but Daisy."
The cake turned out to be loaded with blueberries. Eddie thought it beat by a country mile any cake he'd ever had. He finished three pieces, leaned back, and belched ringingly before he could clap a hand over his mouth. He looked around guiltily. Mercy, the blind woman, cackled.
"I heard that. Someone be thanking the cook, auntie."
"Aye,"
Aunt Talitha said, laughing herself.
"So we do."
The two women who had served the food were returning yet again. One carried a steaming jug. The other had a number of thick ceramic cups balanced precariously on her tray. Aunt Talitha was sitting at the head of the table with Roland by her right hand. Now he leaned over and murmured something in her ear. She listened, her smile fading a little, then nodded.
"Si, Bill, and Till," she said, "you three stay. We are going to have us a little palaver with this gunslinger and his friends, on account of they mean to move along this very afternoon. The rest of you take your coffee in the kitchen, and so cut down the babble. Mind you make your manners before you go."
Bill and Till, the albino twins, remained sitting at the foot of the table. The others formed a line and moved slowly past the travelers. Each of them shook hands with Eddie and Susanna, then kissed Jake on the cheek. The boy accepted this with good grace, but Eddie could see he was both surprised and embarrassed. When they reached Roland, they knelt before him and touched the sandalwood butt of the revolver which jutted from the holster he wore on his left hip. He put his hands on their shoulders and kissed their old brows. Mercy was the last. She flung her arms around Roland's waist and baptized his cheek with a wet, ringing kiss.
"God's bless and keep ye, gunslinger, if only I could see ye. Mind your manners, Mercy,"
Aunt Talitha said sharply. But Roland ignored her and bent over the blind woman. He took her hands gently but firmly in his own and raised them to his face. "See me with these, beauty," he said, and closed his eyes as her fingers, wrinkled and misshapen with arthritis, patted gently over his brow, his cheeks, his lips, and chin.
"Aye, gunslinger,"
she breathed, lifting the sightless sockets of her eyes to his faded blue ones.
"I see you very well. 'Tis a good face, but full of sadness and care. I fear for you and yours."
"Yet we are well met, are we not?" he asked, and planted a gentle kiss on the smooth, worn skin of her forehead.
"Aye, so we are, so we are. Thank ye for your kiss, gunslinger. From my heart I thank ye."
"Go on, Mercy," Aunt Talitha said in a gentler voice. "Get your coffee."
Mercy rose to her feet. The old man with the crutch and peg leg guided her hand to the waistband of his pants. She seized it, and with a final salute to Roland and his band, allowed him to lead her away. Eddie wiped at his eyes, which were wet. "Who blinded her?" he asked hoarsely.
"Harriers," Aunt Talitha said. "Did it with a branding iron, they did. Said it was because she was looking at him pert. 25 years agone, that was. Drink your coffee now, all of you. It's nasty when it's hot, but it ain't nothing but road mud once it's cold."
Eddie lifted the cup to his mouth and sipped experimentally. He wouldn't have gone so far as to call it road mud, but it wasn't exactly Blue Mountain blend either. Susanna tasted hers and looked amazed.
"Why, this is chicory."
Talitha glanced at her.
"I know it not. Docky is all I know. And docky coffee's all we've had since I had the woman's curse. And that curse was lifted from me long, long ago."
"How old are you, ma'am?"
Jake asked suddenly. Aunt Talitha looked at him, surprised, then cackled.
"In truth, lad, I disremember. I recall sitting in this same place and having a party to celebrate my 80, but there were over 50 people sitting out on this lawn that day, and Mercy still had her eyes."
Her own eyes dropped to the bumbler lying at Jake's feet. Oi didn't remove his muzzle from Jake's ankle, but he raised his gold-ringed eyes to gaze at her.
"A Billy Bumbler, b'daisy. It's been long and long since I've seen a bumbler in company with people. Seems they've lost the memory of the days when they walked with men."
One of the albino twins bent down to pat Oi. Oi pulled away from him.
"Once they used to herd sheep,"
Bill, or perhaps it was Till, said to Jake.
"Did you know that, youngster?"
Jake shook his head.
"Do we talk?" the albino asked. "Some did in old days."
Yes, he does.
He looked down at the bumbler, who had returned his head to Jake's ankle as soon as the strange hand left his general area.
Say your name, Oi.
Oi only looked up at him.
Oi,
Jake urged, but Oi was silent. Jake looked at Aunt Talitha and the twins, mildly chagrined.
Well, he does, but I guess he only does it when he wants to.
That boy doesn't look as if he belongs here, Aunt Talitha said to Roland. His clothes are strange, and his eyes are strange as well.
He hasn't been here long. Roland smiled at Jake, and Jake smiled uncertainly back. In a month or two, no one will be able to see his strangeness.
Aye? I wonder, so I do. And where does he come from?
Far from here, the gunslinger said. Very far. She nodded.
And when will he go back?
Never, Jake said. This is my home now.
God's pity you, then, she said, for the sun is going down on the world. It's going down forever.
At that, Susanna stirred uneasily. One hand went to her belly as if her stomach was upset. Suze, Eddie asked, you all right? She tried to smile, but it was a weak effort. Her normal confidence and self-possession seemed to have temporarily deserted her.
Yes, of course. A goose walked over my grave, that's all.
Aunt Talitha gave her a long, assessing look that seemed to make Susanna uncomfortable, and then smiled.
A goose on my grave. Ha! I haven't heard that one in donkey's years.
My dad used to say it all the time.
Susanna smiled at Eddie, a stronger smile this time.
And anyway, whatever it was is gone now. I'm fine.
What do you know about the city and the lands between here and there? Roland asked, picking up his coffee cup and sipping. Are there harriers? And who are these others, these grays and pubes? Aunt Talitha sighed deeply. 8.
Ye'd hear much, gunslinger, and we know but little. One thing I do know is this. The city's an evil place, especially for this youngster, any youngster. Is there any way you can steer around it as you go your course?
Roland looked up and observed the now familiar shape of the clouds as they flowed along the path of the beam. In this wide, plain sky, that shape, like a river in the sky, was impossible to miss. Perhaps, he said at last, but his voice was oddly reluctant. I suppose we could skirt around Ludd to the southwest and pick up the beam on the far side.
It's the beam you follow, she said. I thought so.
Eddie found his own consideration of the city colored by the steadily strengthening hope that when and if they got there, they would find help. Abandoned goodies which would aid them in their quest, or maybe even some people who could tell them a little more about the Dark Tower and what they were supposed to do when they got there. The ones called the Greys, for instance, they sounded like the sort of wise old elves he kept imagining. The drums were creepy, true enough, reminding him of 100 low-budget jungle epics, mostly watched on TV, with Henry by his side and a bowl of popcorn between them, where the fabulous lost cities the explorers had come looking for were in ruins, and the natives had degenerated into tribes of bloodthirsty cannibals. But Eddie found it impossible to believe something like that could have happened in a city that looked, at least from a distance, so much like New York. If there were not wise old elves or abandoned goodies, there would surely be books, at least. He had listened to Roland talk about how rare paper was here, but every city Eddie had ever been in was absolutely drowning in books. They might even find some working transportation. The equivalent of a Land Rover would be nice. That was probably just a silly dream, but when you had thousands of miles of unknown territory to cover, a few silly dreams were undoubtedly in order, if only to keep your spirits up. And weren't those things at least possible, damn it? He opened his mouth to say some of these things, but Jake spoke before he could.
I don't think we can go around, he said,
and then blushed a little when they all turned to look at him. Oi shifted at his feet.
No, Aunt Talitha said. And why do you think that, pray tell?
Do you know about trains? Jake asked.
There was a long silence. Bill and Till exchanged an uneasy glance. Aunt Talitha only looked at Jake steadily. Jake did not drop his eyes.
"I heard the one," she said. "Mayhap even saw it. Over there."
She pointed in the direction of the send.
"Long ago, when I was but a child, and the world hadn't moved on, or at least not so far as it has now. Is it Blaine you speak of, boy?"
Jake's eyes flashed in surprise and recognition.
"Yes, Blaine!"
Roland was studying Jake closely.
"And how would ye know of Blaine the Mono?"
Aunt Talitha asked.
"Mono?"
Jake looked blank.
"Aye, so it was called. How would you know of that old lay?"
Jake looked helplessly at Roland, then back at Aunt Talitha.
"I don't know how I know."
"And that's the truth," Eddie thought suddenly. "But it's not all the truth. He knows more than he wants to tell here, and I think he's scared."
"This is our business, I think," Roland said in a dry, brisk administrator's voice. "You must let us work it out for ourselves, old mother."
"Aye," she agreed quickly. "You'll keep your own counsel. Best that such as us not know."
"What of the city?" Roland prompted. "What do you know of Ludd?"
"Little, now, but what we know ye shall hear."
And she poured herself another cup of coffee. 9. It was the twins, Bill and Till, who actually did most of the talking, one taking up the tale smoothly whenever the other left off. Every now and then, Aunt Talitha would add something or correct something, and the twins would wait respectfully until they were sure she was done. Si didn't speak at all, merely sat with his untouched coffee in front of him, plucking at the pieces of straw which bristled up from the wide brim of his sombrero. They knew little indeed, Roland realized quickly, even about the history of their own town, nor did this surprise him. In these latter days, memories faded rapidly, and all but the most recent past seemed not to exist. But what they did know was disturbing. Roland was not surprised by this, either. In the days of their great-great-grandparents, River Crossing had been much the town Susanna had imagined. A trade stop at the Great Road, modestly prosperous, a place where goods were sometimes sold, but more often exchanged. It had been at least nominally part of River Barony, although even then such things as baronies and estates of land had been passing. There had been buffalo hunters in those days, although the trade had been dying out. The herds were small and badly mutated. The meat of these mutant beasts was not poison, but it had been rank and bitter. Yet River Crossing, located between a place they simply called The Landing and the village of Jimtown, had been a place of some note. It was on the Great Road, and only 6 days' travel from the city by land and 3 by barge.
"Unless the river were low," one of the twins said. "Then it took longer, and my granddad said there were times when there was barges grounded all the way upriver to Tom's Neck."
The old people knew nothing of the city's original residents, of course, or the technologies they had used to build the towers and turrets. These were the great old ones, and their history had been lost in the furthest reaches of the past, even when Aunt Talitha's great-great-grandfather had been a boy.
"The buildings are still standing," Eddie said. "I wonder if the machines the great golden oldies used to build them still run."
"Mayhap," one of the twins said. "If so, young fella, there don't be any man or woman that lives there now who'd still know how to run 'em. Or so I believe, so I do."
"Nay," his brother said argumentatively, "I doubt the old ways are entirely lost to the greys and pubes even now."
He looked at Eddie.
"Our dad said there was once electric candles in the city. There are those who say them out still burn."
"Imagine that," Eddie replied wonderingly, and Susanna pinched his leg hard under the table.
"Yes," the other twin said. He spoke seriously, unaware of Eddie's sarcasm. "You pushed a button and they came on. Bright, heatless candles with airy wicks or reservoirs for oil. And I've heard it said that once, in the old days, Quick, the outlaw prince, actually flew up into the sky in a mechanical bird. But one of its wings broke, and he died in a great fall like Icarus."
Susanna's mouth dropped open.
"You know the story of Icarus?"
"Aye, lady," he said, clearly surprised she should find this strange.
"He of the beeswax wings."
"Children's stories, both of them,"
Aunt Talitha said with a sniff.
"I know the story of the endless lights is true, for I saw them with my own eyes when I was but a green girl, and they may still glow from time to time. Aye, there are those, I trust, who say they've seen them on clear nights, although it's been long years since I have myself. But no man ever flew, not even the great old ones."
Nonetheless, there were strange machines in the city, built to do peculiar and sometimes dangerous things. Many of them might still run, but the elderly twins reckoned that none now in the city knew how to start them up, for they hadn't been heard in years.
"Maybe that could change, though," Eddie thought, his eyes gleaming. "If, that is, an enterprising, travel-minded young man with a little knowledge of strange machinery and endless lights came along, it could be just a matter of finding the on switches. I mean, it really could be that simple. Or maybe they just blew a bunch of fuses. Think of that, friends and neighbors. Just replace half a dozen 400-amp buses and light the whole place up like a Reno Saturday night."
Susanna elbowed him and asked in a low voice what was so funny. Eddie shook his head and put a finger to his lips, earning an irritated look from the love of his life. The albinos, meanwhile, were continuing their story, handing its thread back and forth with the unconscious ease which probably nothing but lifetime twinship can provide. 4 or 5 generations ago, they said, the city had still been quite heavily populated and reasonably civilized, although the residents drove wagons and buckboards along the wide boulevards the great old ones had constructed for their fabulous horseless vehicles. The city dwellers were artisans and what the twins called manufactories, and trade both on the river and over it had been brisk.
"Over it?" Roland asked.
"The bridge over the Seine still stands," Aunt Talitha said, "or did 20 years ago." "Aye, old Bill Muffin and his boy saw it not 10 years agone,"
Si agreed, making his first contribution to the conversation.
"What sort of bridge?" the gunslinger asked.
"A great thing of steel cables," one of the twins said. "It stands in the sky like the web of some great spider," he added shyly. "I should like to see it again before I die."
"Probably fallen in by now," Aunt Talitha said dismissively, "and good riddance, devil's work."
She turned to the twins.
"Tell them what's happened since, and why the city's so dangerous now, apart from any haunts that may den there, that is, and I'll warrant there's a power of 'em. These folks want to get on, and the sun's on the wester."
10. The rest of the story was but another version of a tale Roland of Gilead had heard many times, and had in some measure lived through himself. It was fragmentary and incomplete, undoubtedly shot through with myth and misinformation, its linear progress distorted by the odd changes, both temporal and directional, which were now taking place in the world, and it could be summed up in a single compound sentence. "Once there was a world we knew, but that world has moved on." These old people of River Crossing knew of Gilead no more than Roland knew of the River Barony. And the name of John Farson, the man who had brought ruin and anarchy on Roland's land, meant nothing to them. But all stories of the old world's passing were similar. Too similar, Roland thought, to be coincidence. A great civil war, perhaps in Garland, perhaps in a more distant land called Porla, had erupted 300, perhaps even 400 years ago. Its ripples had spread slowly outward, pushing anarchy and dissension ahead of them. Few, if any, kingdoms had been able to stand against those slow waves, and anarchy had come to this part of the world as surely as night follows sunset. At one time, whole armies had been on the roads, sometimes in advance, sometimes in retreat, always confused and without long-term goals. As time passed, they crumbled into smaller groups, and these degenerated into roving bands of harriers. Trade faltered, then broke down entirely. Travel went from a matter of inconvenience to one of danger. In the end, it became almost impossible. Communication with the city thinned steadily and had all but ceased 120 years ago.
Like 100 other towns Roland had ridden through, first with Cuthbert and the other gunslingers cast out of Gilead, then alone in pursuit of the man in black, River Crossing had been cut off and thrown on its own resources. At this point, Sy roused himself, and his voice captured the travelers at once. He spoke in the hoarse, cadenced tones of a lifelong teller of tales, one of those divine fools born to merge memory and mendacity into dreams as airily gorgeous as cobwebs strung with drops of dew.
"We last sent tribute to the Barony Castle in the time of my great-grandad," he said. 26 men went, with a wagon of hides. There was no hard coin anymore by then, of course, and 'twas the best they could do. It was a long and dangerous journey of almost 80 wheels, and 6 died on the way. Half fell to harriers bound for the war in the city, the other half died either of disease or devil grass. When they finally arrived, they found the castle deserted, but for the rooks and blackbirds. The walls had been broken. Weeds o'ergrew the court estate. There'd been a great slaughter on the fields to the west. It were white with bones and red with rusty armor, so my dad's granddad said. And the voices of demons cried out, like the east wind, from the jawbones of those who'd fallen there. A village beyond the castle had been burned to the ground, and 1,000 or more skulls were posted along the walls of the keep. Our folk left their bounty of hides without the shattered barbican gate, for none would venture inside that place of ghosts and moaning voices, and began the homeward way again. 10 more fell on that journey, so that of the 26 who left, only 10 returned. My great-grandad, one of them. But he picked up a ringworm on his neck and bosom that never left until the day he died. It were the radiation sickness, or so they said. After that, gunslinger, none left the town. We were on our own.
They grew used to the depredations of the harriers, Sy continued in his cracked but melodious voice. Watches were posted. When bands of riders were seen approaching, almost always moving southeast along the great road and the path of the beam, going to the war which raged endlessly in Lud, the townspeople hid in a large shelter they had dug beneath the church. Casual damages to the town were not repaired, lest they make those roving bands curious. Most were beyond curiosity. They only rode through at a gallop, bows or battle axes slung over their shoulders, bound for the killing zones. "What war is it that you speak of?" Roland asked. "Yes," Eddie said, "and what about that drumming sound?" The twins again exchanged a quick, almost superstitious glance.
"We know not of the god drums," Sy told them, "merry word or watch. The war of the city, now."
The war had originally been the harriers and outlaws against a loose confederation of artisans and manufactories who lived in the city. The residents had decided to fight, instead of allowing the harriers to loot them, burn their shops, and then turn the survivors out into the big empty, where they would almost certainly die. And for some years they had successfully defended Lud against the vicious but badly organized groups of raiders which tried to storm across the bridge or invade by boat and barge.
"The city folk used old weapons," one of the twins said, "and though their numbers were small, the harriers could not stand against such things with their bows and maces and battle axes."
"Do you mean the city people used guns?" Eddie asked. One of the albinos nodded.
"Aye, guns. But not just guns. There were things that hurled the firebangs over a mile or more. Explosions like dynamite, only more powerful. The outlaws, who are now the Greys, as you must ken, could do nothing but lay siege beyond the river, and that was what they did."
Lud became, in effect, the last fortress refuge of the latter world. The brightest and most able traveled there from the surrounding countryside by ones and twos. When it came to intelligence tests, sneaking through the tangled encampments and front lines of the besiegers was the newcomer's final exam. Most came unarmed across the no-man's land of the bridge, and those who made it that far were let through. Some were found wanting and sent packing again, of course, but those who had a trade or a skill or brains enough to learn one were allowed to stay. Farming skills were particularly prized. According to the stories, every large park in Ludd had been turned into a vegetable garden. With the countryside cut off, it was grow food in the city or starve amid the glass towers and metal alleys. The great old ones were gone, their machines were a mystery, and the silent wonders which remained were inedible. Little by little, the character of the war began to change. The balance of power had shifted to the besieging Greys, so-called because they were, on average, much older than the city dwellers. Those latter were also growing older, of course. They were still known as pubes, but in most cases their puberty was long behind them. And they eventually either forgot how the old weapons worked or used them up.
"Probably both," Roland grunted.
Some 90 years ago, within the lifetimes of Sy and Aunt Talitha, a final band of outlaws had appeared, one so large that the outriders had gone galloping through river crossing at dawn, and the drogues did not pass until almost sundown. It was the last army these parts had ever seen, and it was led by a warrior prince named David Quick, the same fellow who supposedly later fell to his death from the sky. He had organized the raggle-taggle remnants of the outlaw bands which still hung about the city, killing anyone who showed opposition to his plans. Quick's army of Greys used neither boat nor bridge to attempt entry into the city, but instead built a pontoon bridge 12 miles below it and attacked on the flank.
"Since then the war has guttered like a chimney fire," Aunt Talitha finished. "We hear reports every now and then from someone who's managed to leave. Aye, so we do. These come a little more often now, for the bridge, they say, is undefended, and I think the fire is almost out. Within the city, the pubes and Greys squabble over the remaining spoils, only I reckon that the descendants of the Harriers who followed Quick over the pontoon bridge are the real pubes now, although they are still called Greys. The descendants of the original city dwellers must now be almost as old as we are, although there are still some younkers who go to be among them, drawn by the old stories and the lure of the knowledge which may still remain there. These two sides still keep up their old enmity, gunslinger, and both would desire this young man you call Eddie. If the dark-skinned woman is fertile, they would not kill her even though her legs are short-ended. They would keep her to bear children. For children are fewer now, and although the old sicknesses are passing, some are still born strange."
At this, Susanna stirred, seemed about to say something, then only drank the last of her coffee and settled back into her former listening position.
"But if they would desire the young man and woman, gunslinger, I think they would lust for the boy."
Jake bent and began to stroke Oi's fur again. Roland saw his face and knew what he was thinking. It was the passage under the mountains all over again, just another version of the slow mutants.
"You, they'd just as soon kill," Aunt Talitha said, "for you are a gunslinger, a man out of his own time and place, neither fish nor fowl, and no use to either side. But a boy can be taken, used, schooled to remember some things and to forget all the others. They've all forgotten whatever it was they had to fight about in the first place. The world has moved on since then. Now they just fight to the sound of them awful drumbeats, some few still young, most of them old enough for the rocking chair like us here, all of them stupid grots who only live to kill and kill to live."
She paused.
"Now that you've heard us old collies to the end, are you sure it would not be best to go around and leave them to their business?"
Before Roland could reply, Jake spoke up in a clear, firm voice. "Tell what you know about Blaine the Mono," he said. "Tell about Blaine and Engineer Bob." 11.
"Engineer who?" Eddie asked, but Jake only went on looking at the old people.
"Track lies over yonder," Sy answered at last. He pointed toward the river. "One track only, set up high on a column of man-made stone, such as old ones used to make their streets and walls."
"A monorail!" Susanna exclaimed. "Blaine the monorail!"
"Blaine is a pain,"
Jake muttered. Roland glanced at him, but said nothing. "Does this train run now?" Eddie asked Sy. Sy shook his head slowly. His face was troubled and uneasy.
"No, young sir, but in my lifetime and Auntie's it did. When we were green and the war of the city still went forward briskly. We'd hear it before we saw it, a low humming noise, a sound like you sometimes hear when a bad summer storm's on the way, one that's full of lightning."
"Aye," Aunt Talitha said. Her face was lost and dreaming.
"Then it'd come, Blaine the Mono, twinkling in the sun, with a nose like one of the bullets in your revolver, gunslinger, maybe 2 wheels long. I know that sounds like it couldn't be, and maybe it wasn't. We were green, you must remember, and that makes a difference. But I still think it was, for when it came, it seemed to run along the whole horizon, fast, low, and gone before you could even see it proper. Sometimes, on days when the weather were foul and the air low, it'd shriek like a harpy as it came out of the west. Sometimes it'd come in the night, with a long white light spread out before it, and that shriek would wake all of us. It were like the trumpet they say will raise the dead from their graves at the end of the world, so it was."
"Tell 'em about the bangs, Si," Bill or Till said, in a voice which trembled with awe.
"Tell 'em about the godless bang, what always came after."
"I was just getting to that," Si answered, with a touch of annoyance.
"After it passed by, there would be quiet for a few seconds, sometimes as long as a minute, maybe. And then there'd come an explosion that rattled the boards and knocked cups off the shelves and sometimes even broke the glass in the window panes. But never did anyone see airy flash nor fire. It was like an explosion in the world of spirits."
Eddie tapped Susanna on the shoulder, and when she turned to him, he mouthed 2 words, "Sonic boom." It was nuts. No train he had ever heard of traveled faster than the speed of sound, but it was also the only thing that made sense. She nodded and turned back to Sy.
"It's the only one of the machines the great old ones made that I've ever seen running with my own eyes," he said in a soft voice. "And if it weren't the devil's work, there'd be no devil. The last time I saw it was the spring I married Mercy, and that must have been 60 years agone."
70, Aunt Talitha said with authority. "And this train went into the city," Roland said. "From back the way we came, from the west, from the forest."
"Aye," a new voice said, unexpectedly, "but there was another, one that went out from the city. And mayhap that one still runs."
12. They turned. Mercy stood by a bed of flowers between the back of the church and the table where they sat. She was walking slowly toward the sound of their voices, with her hands spread out before her. Sy got clumsily to his feet, hurried to her as best he could, and took her hand. She slipped an arm about his waist, and they stood there, looking like the world's oldest wedding couple.
"Auntie told you to take your coffee inside," he said. "Finished my coffee long ago," Mercy said. "It's a bitter brew, and I hate it. Besides, I wanted to hear the palaver."
She raised a trembling finger and pointed it in Roland's direction.
"I wanted to hear his voice. It's fair and light, so it is." "I cry your pardon, Auntie," Si said, looking at the ancient woman a little fearfully. "She was never one to mind, and the years have made her no better."
Aunt Talitha glanced at Roland. He nodded almost imperceptibly.
"Let her come forward and join us," she said.
Sy led her over to the table, scolding all the while. Mercy only looked over his shoulder with her sightless eyes, her mouth set in an intractable line. When Sy had gotten her seated, Aunt Talitha leaned forward on her forearms and said,
"Now, do you have something to say, old sister Sy, or were you just beating your gums?" "I hear what I hear. My ears are sharp as they ever were, Talitha. Sharper."
Roland's hand dropped to his belt for a moment.
When he brought it back to the table, he was holding a cartridge in his fingers. He tossed it to Susanna, who caught it.
"Do you sigh?" he asked.
"Well enough," she said, turning in his direction, "to know that you just threw something to your woman, I think, the one with the brown skin, something small. What was it, gunslinger, a biscuit?"
"Close enough," he said, smiling. "You hear as well as you say. Now tell us what you meant."
"There is another mono," she said, "unless 'tis the same one running a different course. Either way, a different course was run by some mono, until 7 or 8 years ago, anyways. I used to hear it leaving the city and going out into the wastelands beyond."
"Dung heap," one of the albino twins ejaculated. "Nothing goes to the wastelands. Nothing can live there."
She turned her face to him.
"Is a train alive, Till Tudbury?" she asked. "Does a machine fall sick with sores and puking?"
Well, Eddie thought of saying, there was this bear. He thought it over a little more and decided it might be better to keep his silence.
"We would have heard it,"
the other twin was insisting, hotly.
"A noise like the one Si always tells of. This one didn't make no bang," she admitted. "But I heard that other sound, that humming noise like the one you hear sometimes after lightning has struck somewhere close. When the wind was strong, blown out from the city, I heard it."
She thrust out her chin and added,
"I did hear the bang once, too, from far, far out. The night Big Charlie Wind came and almost blew the steeple off the church. Must have been 200 wheels from here, maybe 250.
"Bull dink!" the twin cried. "You've been chewing the weed. I chew on you, Bill Tudbury, if you don't shut up your honking. You've no business saying bull dink to a lady, either. Why, stop it, Mercy," Si hissed.
But Eddie was barely listening to this exchange of rural pleasantries. What the blind woman had said made sense to him. Of course there would be no sonic boom, not from a train which started its run in Ludd. He couldn't remember exactly what the speed of sound was, but he thought it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 650 miles an hour. A train starting from a dead stop would take some time getting up to that speed, and by the time it reached it, it would be out of earshot. Unless the listening conditions happened to be just right, as Mercy claimed they had been on the night when the Big Charlie Wind, whatever that was, had come. And there were possibilities here. Blaine the Mono was no Land Rover, but maybe... "You haven't heard the sound of this other train for 7 or 8 years, Si?" Roland asked. "Are you sure it wasn't much longer?"
"Couldn't have been," she said, "for the last time was the year old Bill Muffin took blood sick. Poor Bill." "That's almost 10 year agone," Aunt Talitha said, and her voice was queerly gentle. "Why did you never say you heard such a thing?" Si asked.
He looked at the gunslinger.
"You can't believe everything she says, Lord. Always longing to be in the middle of the stage is my Mercy." "Why, you old slumgullion," she cried, and slapped his arm. "I didn't say because I didn't want to o'ertop the story you're so proud of. But now that it matters what I heard, I'm bound to tell."
"I believe you, Si," Roland said. "But are you sure you haven't heard the sounds of the mono since then?"
"Nay, not since then. I imagine it's finally reached the end of its path."
"I wonder," Roland said. "Indeed, I wonder very much." He looked down at the table, brooding, suddenly far away from all of them. "Choo-choo," Jake thought, and shivered. 13. Half an hour later, they were in the town square again, Susanna in her wheelchair, Jake adjusting the straps of his pack, while Oi sat at his heel, watching him attentively. Only the town elders had attended the dinner party in the little Eden behind the Church of the Blood Everlasting, it seemed, because when they returned to the square, another dozen people were waiting. They glanced at Susanna and looked a bit longer at Jake, his youth apparently more interesting to them than her dark skin. But it was clearly Roland they had come to see. Their wondering eyes were full of ancient awe. "He's a living remnant of a past they only know from stories," Susanna thought.
They look at him the way religious people would look at one of the saints, Peter or Paul or Matthew, if he decided to drop by the Saturday night bean supper and tell them stories of how it was traipsing around the Sea of Galilee with Jesus the carpenter. The ritual which had ended the meal was now repeated, only this time everyone left in River Crossing participated. They shuffled forward in a line, shaking hands with Eddie and Susanna, kissing Jake on the cheek or forehead, then kneeling in front of Roland for his touch and his blessing. Mercy threw her arms about him and pressed her blind face against his stomach. Roland hugged her back and thanked her for her news.
"Will ye not stay the night with us, gunslinger? Sunset comes on apace, and it's been long since you and yours spent the night beneath the roof, I warrant."
"It has been, but it's best we go on. Thank you, Si."
"Will ye come again, if ye may, gunslinger?"
"Yes," Roland said. But Eddie did not need to look into his strange friend's face to know the chances were small. "If we can."
"Aye."
She hugged him a final time, then passed on with her hand resting on Si's sunburned shoulder.
"Fare ye well."
Aunt Talitha came last. When she began to kneel, Roland caught her by the shoulders. "No, Si, you shall not do." And before Eddie's amazed eyes, Roland knelt before her in the dust of the town square. "Will you bless me, old mother? Will you bless all of us as we go our course?"
"Aye,"
she said. There was no surprise in her voice, no tears in her eyes, but her voice throbbed with deep feeling all the same.
"I see your heart is true, gunslinger, and that you hold to the old ways of your kind. Aye, you hold to them very well. I bless you and yours, and will pray that no harm will come to ye. Now, take this, if you will."
She reached into the bodice of her faded dress and removed a silver cross at the end of a fine link silver chain. She took it off. Now it was Roland's turn to be surprised. "Are you sure? I did not come to take what belongs to you and yours, old mother."
"I'm sure can be. I've worn this day and night for over 100 years, gunslinger. Now you shall wear it, and lay it at the foot of the dark tower, and speak the name of Talitha Unwin at the far end of the earth."
She slipped the chain over his head. The cross dropped into the open neck of his deerskin shirt as if it belonged there.
"Go now. We have broken bread, we have held palaver, we have your blessing, and you have ours. Go your course in safety. Stand and be true."
Her voice trembled and broke on the last word. Roland rose to his feet, then bowed and tapped his throat 3 times.
"Thank you, Si."
She bowed back, but did not speak. Now there were tears coursing down her cheeks.
"Ready?" Roland asked.
Eddie nodded. He did not trust himself to speak.
"All right," Roland said. "Let's go."
They walked down what remained of the town's high street, Jake pushing Susanna's wheelchair. As they passed the last building, "Trade and Change," the faded sign read, he looked back. The old people were still gathered about the stone marker, a forlorn cluster of humanity in the middle of this wide, empty plain. Jake raised his hand. Up to this point he had managed to hold himself in, but when several of the old folks, Si, Bill, and Till, among them, raised their own hands in return, Jake burst into tears himself. Eddie put an arm around his shoulders. "Just keep walking, sport," he said in an uneasy voice. "That's the only way to do it."
"They're so old," Jake sobbed. "How can we just leave them like this? It's not right."
"It's Kaa," Eddie said without thinking.
"Is it? Well, Kaa sucks.
"Yeah, hard," Eddie agreed. But he kept walking. So did Jake, and he didn't look back again. He was afraid they would still be there, standing at the center of their forgotten town, watching until Roland and his friends were out of view.
and he would have been right.